Welcome to The Squeal, PIC's swine management podcast, featuring in-depth conversations on topics that matter to you. PIC is the global leader in swine genetics. At PIC, our goal is to make our customers the most successful pig producers by providing them with the best genetics. We know our business success depends on yours. Today, our team of experts addresses a topic of greatest concern to the collective industry mind, biosecurity. Sharing hands-on techniques and implementation ideas are today's guest, Dr. Joel Neerham of Pipestone Veterinary Services, Dr. Andrea Pitkin, and Dr. Jess Waddell, specialist with PIC's Health Assurance Team.
My name is Joel Neerham. I'm a veterinarian with Pipestone Veterinary Services in Pipestone, Minnesota. Swine practitioner there. I've been on staff at Pipestone for about 12 years. Prior to that, I was in mixed practice and also worked for an integrated pork producer for a period of time.
I'm Andrea Pitkin. I'm with PIC on the Health Assurance Veterinary Team. I've been with PIC just over a year and a half. And previous experience, I was in practice for about 5.5 years in southern Minnesota before joining PIC. And prior to that, I got a master's degree which focused on biosecurity. So this is a very passionate topic for me.
Jess Waddell, also with PIC Health Assurance, based in Nebraska, was most recently with a large producer in Nebraska and western Iowa, and been with PIC for 2 years.
So a passion, Andrea, you said. What drove that?
Well, and ultimately, I would much rather prevent disease than have to deal with it. And I think that over the years, the work that's been done, we have really great protocols and processes and things that we can tailor to numerous situations, numerous farms, numerous people, as long as we follow the basic rules of the absolute do's and don'ts. I think that a lot of things can be prevented. You know, as far as disease breaks, we just have to have the want, the determination, the passion, if you will, to do so. And I think that getting that message out there to producers and farm owners is very important.
Let's create a definition of biosecurity on the fly. So somebody start off, what do you think is the key elements of biosecurity, and then others add in?
I think when most veterinarians, producers think of biosecurity as bioexclusion. So we're preventing any pathogen, any fomite from carrying a disease into your population of animals.
We'd often define it as just simply keeping disease out. And it's all the things that we do on a farm or even off the farm to prevent a new disease from entering a group of animals.
I think I would add to that that it's a mindset. I think you have lots of different protocols, but biosecurity, if anything, is more of a mindset. It's the determined desire to follow those protocols, whatever works for your farm, that you want to and are going to actively work to keep disease out.
I think it's almost a culture. Yeah. I think oftentimes it has to become part of the culture of a farm or of a team that works on a farm in order for it really to take on life and in order for it to happen day in, day out, because it's something that doesn't happen from 8 to 5. It has to be 24/7. It has to be on the weekends. It has to be on the holidays. It just has to be part of what we do every day. And it's often not convenient. The things that we're talking about that are going to prevent disease are not convenient, and that's why it has to be culture. It has to be just ingrained, I think.
So driving that culture, not necessarily in the barn, but into an operation where they've had some issues. We know it hits them in the pocketbook, but what causes that heart change that means, oh, we're going to have to change the way we do things rather than, doc, give us a shot?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the driver is when something happens. I think that they hear us say, you need to follow this protocol, and it's expensive, and it's time-consuming, and it's inconvenient. But once a disease does come in and they know that it could have been prevented, it seems like, unfortunately, it's not until they get burned that it really starts to hit home. I wish it wasn't that way. But I think more often or not, in the experiences I've had, when people truly grasp onto biosecurity, it's because they've had an unfortunate event and now they're, maybe not necessarily backpedaling, but trying to recorrect what went wrong.
I think it starts just when everybody is on the boat and rowing in the same direction, and it can't work with just the barn personnel. It's maintenance and the veterinary staff. It's the owners, all of the above rowing in the same direction and committed, because as Dr. Neerham said, it's not convenient.
As was said earlier, it's a mindset, and I think it's a mindset by everyone involved that this is my farm. I'm taking ownership of this farm, and so what would the owner do? How would the owner work to protect their herd? It's my herd too, and so that's one of the things I think that when a farm manager and when the staff really take ownership of the farm, they won't let anybody do something that goes against the biosecurity protocol, if you will, because they know of the risk that it presents to the animals in their care. And so really, until people buy in and absolutely take ownership, I don't know that we get the full value of the protocols that we put in place to protect the farm.
In some of our other topics, we've talked about sometimes people are afraid to speak out. So in this type of a biosecurity discussion, instructing each other, teaching each other, making sure that they realize that it's a mindset, but because one failure is total failure.
It's clearly defining the processes so everybody knows the boundaries, exactly what that protocol means, allowing them to have input to make it as convenient as possible but still serve the purpose. Really drives that point. So everybody knows the rules so they can call each other out, one. And there's different methods you can have those reporting. But the culture, biosecurity culture, extends to the barn staff. I mean, if they've got a manager that is working with them and it's not a dictatorship, they can push that information up and down and sideways, and everybody knows the why they're doing it, why they're doing those processes, and it's to make their job easier in the long run.
I think there's a really delicate balance when it comes to compliance with respect to biosecurity, and to your point about making sure that people speak up when something is wrong, because everyone on the farm is accountable to follow the protocols, and so there has to be some accountability. You have to sort of hold people's feet to the fire in some ways. But you also have to have a mechanism where people aren't afraid to step up and say, hey, something happened that shouldn't have happened, so that we can fix it, right? Or so that we can react to prevent the worst case scenario, if that makes any sense. But it's a really delicate balance. I don't know that there's a prescribed way to have that happen. I think it goes back to the culture of the organization and just trying to get people to own it.
I think what can help with that is a good biosecurity protocol will have one layer, maybe two. A really good biosecurity protocol will have three, if not four, layers. And so when you have a protocol, let's say that it has to have four sets of failures before you have the break, you can make a failure in one of those, and then that creates a teaching moment. And so I think that, you know, we need to do a better job of, when we talk to personnel and owners, that, you know, this is, you know, a protocol that we want to put in place. It has various fail-stop mechanisms or processes throughout it. And then, you know, that way then, you know, we communicate that on to the farm staff and say, look, we don't want you to make mistakes, but know that maybe here in this one step or that step, we still have a chance to rectify the situation. And I think that that's really important for them to understand. I'm stealing this line from Dr. Jared Geiger that works with us. He is constantly trying to remind us you have to do first why, then how. Why are we doing this? And I think that that is absolutely key when it comes to biosecurity. Because if I tell you, you gotta jump on one foot and rub your belly to go through this process of biosecurity, you're gonna look at me like I have three heads. But if I say, well, if you do this, this is why it's gonna prevent disease, and they can't hear the jump on one foot, they have to hear, if you step here and you put boots on here, this is going to prevent disease crossing this point in the farm.
I think Dr. Pitkin makes a great point in that today there's so much science that's gone into developing the protocols that we have, and I'm the only one with gray hair here, so I remember the time before a lot of that work was done, and we would tell people, well, you need to do this, this, and this. And it was like, well, why do you do it? Well, because I said so. But I had nothing to back me up, no data, no research that was done that said, yeah, this really does work. And so in the last 12 to 15 years, there have been a number of really smart people in our industry, and Dr. Pitkin actually worked on some projects that proved some of these protocols work. And so I think that's a key today, that we can point to that research to show people, hey, there's a reason why we're asking you to do this. It's not because we pulled it out of the air and it sounded really good, because that's what they did 20 years ago. But today we've got good data, and I think that helps sort of explain it or drive that message. So,
Dr. Pitkin, you said you called it layering, and I think I know what you're referring to, but give us a for instance. How might that look?
Yeah, an easy example is farm entry. So typically, you pull up to a farm if you have a designated farm staff parking lot versus a visitor parking lot. So you're creating separation there. You have a designated path. You have people walk to come into the farm. You might have a shoe cover policy when exiting your vehicle. When you first enter the building proper, you're on what we call a dirty side entry. And that's usually got a good source of heat. It's kept clean. It's routinely disinfected. You drop your shoes there after crossing over a bench, and we have very deliberate bench crossing protocols where you don't let your socks touch the dirty side of the floor when you swing your legs over. And now you go into a dirty side of the shower, and you know all your personal items are removed. You shower, you come in. So that's a good example of, you could have one of those processes potentially fail. Hopefully it's sooner than later in that process, but that's the idea of generating layers to a personnel entry protocol, for example, and get clean, dirty lines are another example of that, where you set that and where people can and can't cross. So those really have to be tailored to the farm and to the people, and get their input on how is this going to work for you, and how can we make this efficient, and where can we set these, but we know that at this point is an absolute, so to speak.
I've often heard that described as redundancy, another way of saying layers. Someone way smarter than me said that one time. It stuck. It's like, yeah, we need to have redundant interventions. Exactly what you described with layers. So that if one fails, yeah.
Dr. Waddell mentioned a little while ago fomite, which, you know, makes us all think of Dr. D's fomites from hell studies that really kind of open the curtain on a lot of these. Dr. Pitkin mentions the transportation, bringing in as we actually enter the barn to work. What are some of the other vectors you've seen deliver the bug to the wrong side of the line?
The most efficient way to move a pig disease is with another pig. And so making sure that you have the right testing protocols and the right quarantine protocols for breeding stock, particularly when you're thinking about a sow farm operation, we often overlook that, but there was a time when we didn't quarantine well and we didn't test well. And I think whenever we start talking about biosecurity, I would start with the pig or with the semen. Those biological vectors that can bring a disease. And then we get to fomites and we start talking about disinfection and downtime and some of those kinds of things, making sure that your source of anything that you're bringing to the farm is verified, as a clean source. Sanitation is always a critical point when we talk about biosecurity, particularly at any point where you're going to bring something from outside the farm across the clean, dirty line and into the farm. Those points need to be very well controlled. They need to be very clean, and the processes need to be simple and understood.
Yeah, the fomite piece is everything under the sun that goes into the farm. It's as basic as the pigs, the people, the feed, and the supplies. And if you really start to think about how many times we do cross over the clean, dirty lines or those critical control points, it's really staggering, from people to lunches to supplies to semen. And there's a lot of points throughout the day that we can mess that up and present a risk to our farms.
I would say that there needs to be a process that's followed anytime we bring something across that line into the farm, without exception. There needs to be a process that's been verified as effective, sort of getting back to the research that's been done, and there's been a lot of work that's been done. The other thing I think that's important is that there can't be exceptions. Nobody is above the law, if you will, when it comes to biosecurity. And I used to tell farm managers, I don't care if the owner shows up and tries to break biosecurity, your job is to hold them accountable, because nobody is above the law. Nobody, and that is the thing that will erode biosecurity compliance and biosecurity culture the fastest, is if there are certain people that the biosecurity rules don't apply to. Because if that's the case, then the people that are on the farm every day will understand, it must not be that important if they don't have to follow it. So when no one's looking, I shouldn't have to either. And so I think that's one of the most critical things. Every person that comes to the farm has to follow all the rules all the time without exception.
Yeah, completely agree. And to your question about, you know, what things bring disease to a site, I mean, absolutely 100% agree with Dr. Nurum that your pig coming in or your semen coming in is your most easy vector, because that's what's carrying the disease. So I think something to point out is all the things that can bring disease, whether it's people entry, fomites, transportation, manure hauling, mortality, removals, all those different things, people have to do those processes and procedures. So I really think that, you know, getting people educated, but getting people to understand the why and the how, it's, you know, you can say it was a dirty trailer. Well, who didn't clean the trailer properly? Who crossed the clean, dirty line? You could say it was a fomite. Well, where did that fomite get left? Or how did that fomite get transported? There's, I guess, probably with the exception of aerosol, and maybe a little bit if a pig gets infected, people touch all of these processes, and they are critical to train and educate and understand.
One of the things that has been a recurring theme here at PIC in our conversations today is how PIC takes into account the capabilities of the operation where they're trying to help. Talk about that from biosecurity. I mean, is there a hierarchy of biosecurity issues if you go into a less than optimal operation related to biosecurity? Where, how do you start? I mean, I assume there are conversations that go on, but what's the hierarchy of it? What's the approach? What's the attack? What's the plan of attack as we find an operation like that?
It's a good question, Ned. I don't know. You start with the most glaring opportunities, the ones that are low-hanging fruit, the easiest to fix, so they can see that process or that progress immediately, and then work from there. As the cost of failure increases the higher you go, as far as the more redundancy you put into the process. But you start with the easy stuff, making sure their quarantines are long enough, the diagnostics are completed before we bring semen into the farm, and then work from there.
I think it's easy for farms to understand if you have a dirty trailer back up to your farm, and trailers are just easy to pick on, but that's a big risk event, you know, unloading, loading animals, having that there. How is that any more or less of a risk? Say that trailer shows up once a week versus you have 15 farm staff that all 15 are taking two showers, showering in and out every day, or bringing in lunch. If you have 15 people bringing in a lunch, I mean, that's 30 events every day of something crossing the clean, dirty line versus a trailer that shows up once a week. So I think that there's definitely higher risk things, or, you know, the low-hanging fruit is where you want to go first, but I don't think it should be too far off that you push in other areas as well. I mean, as, you know, Dr. Nurum was saying, anything that crosses from outside to inside really needs to be evaluated and looked at. And how are we bringing this into the farm, or how are we having it exit the farm and have confidence that it's clean?
It can be a complicated question to your question about where do you start, right? You're at a farm, and it's like, okay, there's a whole bunch of stuff here that needs fixed. And there's the low-hanging fruit, which is a great approach because you fix the things that are easy, right? Easy, quote unquote. But then there's also certain things, to your point, Dr. Pitkin, where there's a way different risk level, right? And so you have to address both of those, because farm staff will look and say, well, yeah, we're addressing this low-hanging fruit risk right here, but even they're smart enough to know that the biggest risk is over here. And if management hasn't decided to allocate the capital or the other resources that are needed to fix that one, it's pretty hard to get buy-in, right? Again, so it's all about buy-in of the staff. It's all about the culture. And so it becomes a more difficult sort of endeavor than what it would seem at face value oftentimes. At least that's been my experience. One of the ways that we would describe this is biosecurity is a ground war. It's trench warfare. It is not calling in an airstrike with some B-52s and dropping bombs and blowing up the enemy and going away, right? It's all about in the trenches every day. It's a ground war. It's boots on the ground, and you don't win it just like that. And so it's about a commitment. It's about resources. It's about changing the culture. It's about being committed for the long haul. And too often, I think human nature is, let's call in the B-52s and drop some bombs and fix this and fly away. And that isn't how you, I think, long-term protect a farm.
I think you made a very good point with the people on the ground. They know where the deficiencies are. So if you start there and ask them what the glaring holes are, they know. And then typically if it's someone else's idea, the buy-in, it travels a lot faster. And so you can make a lot of headway in a hurry, and you can help explain the why in the process, and then it really comes together pretty quick.
The other thing that we found is that it isn't just about rewriting the protocol and throwing some money at the problem. It's about a long-term commitment, and it's about follow-up to the farm. And so I believe very strongly in an auditing process that helps support the farm to make sure that once we're back on the road, that we stay on the road. And it's not auditing in the sense that we're going to go out and do a gotcha kind of thing, right? We're going to catch them doing something wrong. It's really about a long-term approach to supporting the farm, to help them make sure that they're executing all of the protocols all the time. Because these farms today are complicated. There's a lot of technology. There's a lot of work that gets done every day to take care of pigs and to perform at a high level. And so their sole focus every day, 24/7, isn't always biosecurity, right? And so the support we can bring as veterinarians, as health professionals, as other folks that come to the farm is to help make sure that we've got a scorecard that keeps everybody on the road.
Well, unfortunately, we have a lot of turnover. So to your point, continual auditing and continual follow-up that processes are being done is, you know, a lot of times could be just an innocent, well, I'm new here and I don't know, I haven't been trained. And so definitely need auditing, you know, completely agree that it is not to catch you in the act. It's not to point the finger and try to find you doing something wrong. It's to help support and make sure that we're doing everything that we can right.
What's an auditing procedure look like?
I have my biases. To me, the audit is observational. Well, first of all, the audit has to fit the protocol, has to fit what the expectations are. So you can't audit people that when they don't know what the rules of the game are. So there has to be a very clear protocol, as has already been stated. The staff have to be trained on that protocol. They have to know what the expectation is. And then to me, the audit is more focused on going out and observing whether or not the protocol is being followed. It isn't going out and asking people if they know what they're supposed to do, because they generally always know what they're supposed to do, but they aren't always doing it. And so the audit really should be focused on, are we doing what we say we're going to do? And so then there should be certain criteria that are established, whether that be looking at the sanitation of the various critical access points to the farm. That, to me, is a key area that can be audited. It can be looking at some of the other activities that often need to be logged or recorded that this was done. For instance, bait rotation as part of the rodent control program at the farm. It's a very easy thing to have a checklist that someone checks those bait stations at whatever time period is appropriate, and then they sign off on that, right? You can audit that sort of thing. If I ask them, they'll say, yeah, we're supposed to check the bait box, right? So it's those kinds of things. And I think the other key then is determining what are the critical things that have to be done. What are the most critical things? You could argue that the bait boxes aren't the most critical thing that I should audit, but it might be whether or not we are doing everything as it relates to quarantine and testing of incoming breeding stock. That might be a little higher level. Or it might be observing for sanitation and following the correct procedures for shower and shower out of staff members. Or whether or not the correct procedure is being followed for the disinfection and quarantine of incoming materials to the farm, supplies, etc. Those would be places where I would focus an audit just to make sure that the right processes are being followed.
I think a really good process is show me how you brought semen in this morning, or having the people that are actually doing the task demonstrate it right there in front of you. You may not get to see the process every time you're making a visit, but you can use props and have them show you how they did it. And a good example of that is the lunches. If you're using a double bag process, you can have a little demonstration right there for everybody.
I think when you do an audit, you intuitively know what's higher risk and what's lower risk. And maybe I'm being unfair or mean, but I think that in a sense, even though we know, like you said, rodent bait is probably not as high a risk as, say, your trailer washing process, but I'm not going to tell the farm staff that. I'm going to say this is biosecurity, all aspects, and I want them to think that the rodent bait is just as important as how we're washing, even though I know, you know, we've got different levels of risks on either of those. And I think that helps promote the biosecurity culture, is that when you, again, you get into that mindset of, you know, I'm trying to think of another process. The double bagging, or shoe covers, or washing your vehicle before you come. Those are all small aspects, but they're all still really important to, again, setting the mindset.
One thing that some farms will do is incentivize people with respect to passing the audit. And I know of some farms or production systems that, based on the performance of a particular farm team on an audit, they'll get a monetary bonus. And sometimes that is an effective way to stimulate people to do the right thing. Sometimes there's negatives too, where you like post the results of all the audits so the entire company sees who's passing and who's not. And so there's varying ways to use audits and to sort of lever them a little bit, right? Right or wrong, that's what some people do. I think there's pluses and minuses to that, but definitely can inspire people in the behavior that we're asking for sometimes.
Dr. Neal, who is responsible for audits? Who do you think drives that?
My bias is that an audit should be conducted by someone that is not within the reporting chain of command necessarily of the individuals being audited. Third party is what I would say. That's my particular bias. The example I often give is particularly with related to trailer cleaning. So it's good to have the person washing the trailer inspect the trailer, but a real third party audit is somebody else coming in from the outside to inspect the trailer, and someone that doesn't care if we have to rewash this trailer again and delay the movement of pigs by 2 hours or longer. Because if it's the truck driver, he wants to get on the road to go pick up the pigs and get moving, right? He's not incented to have his first incentive is to get his job done, right? If it's the production guy, he might be the same way. I got to get these pigs going and I don't want to wait and we're not going to. So to me, it's somebody that doesn't care if the truck wash staff walks off the job today. It's someone that doesn't care if we don't wean the pigs as quick as we want to and it's going to disrupt the activities of the farm. It's got to be someone whose sole focus is this trailer is clean and it will not be a risk to infecting the farm.
I think everybody visiting the farm, so from the owners, production managers, everyone has to be looking at the scorecard, the defined processes every single time, because if someone of status sees a process that isn't right, isn't correct, and doesn't correct the people doing the process, it only validates that process or demeans that process or devalues it for the future.
Observation was mentioned earlier. Are cameras okay? Do you use those? Is that a way to see if those critical areas are being maintained?
There's more and more cameras being put on farms today. I do know that. It's not something that we've used a lot historically to monitor biosecurity. I think that it will be a practice used more and more. I think today, oftentimes, cameras are being put on farms simply to let folks that don't have a farming background be able to see what's happening inside a farm. I think that's a great thing for society, for the consumer, is to see what's happening within a farm. The problem with cameras is you have to sit and watch the tape. And so nobody, has that kind of time, right? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree. More and more cameras are coming into farms, and I think that technology's allowed us to be a little smarter with them, that they're set up to motion. So if you're monitoring a room, mm-hmm. to your point of not having to sit there and watch 24 hours worth of tape, it doesn't start recording until it sees motion. So you can at least tailor that down to an event that you want to see, or did someone follow the process or the protocol. I'm back and forth on cameras. I think that they could help us understand. But there was a pretty significant research study that was done, and I believe it was the poultry group, where they had cameras in a lot of their farms. And what they found is for the first few months, people were very, you know, oh, I'm going to follow this, I'm going to do this. They, you know, nose to the grindstone were doing what they were going to do. But then over time, it's like they didn't care anymore that they were being watched, and it went back downhill again to not following protocols. So I don't know that cameras are completely the answer to get compliance, but they definitely can show us if something occurs, if they're recording at the right angle at the right moment.
I think you're exactly right. I've heard that very same perspective, in that you put cameras in, they're not a great compliance tool, because for the first couple of weeks, they'll be aware that they're there, someone's watching, I got to be very, very careful. And then I think it was Dr. John Dean, actually, that was working on a project with me years and years ago. He wanted to put cameras in a farm that I was working with. And I was like, what do you mean? We're not going to see anything. He's like, oh, yeah, I know. He says within a couple of weeks, they'll be right back to their old habits. And that's exactly what we found. So.
Questions for each other. Things that may have been said today in here, or just something that you're curious about that one of your other experts might have more insight into.
Dr. Niram, how do you evaluate protocols and make sure they're current and that everyone is knowledgeable to the expectations?
That's a good question. So auditing of what's happening on the farm is a good way to understand whether protocols are being followed and are current. I think an annual review of your biosecurity protocols is a good practice to make sure that what we're doing is still relevant, and that there hasn't been research that would say that maybe a certain practice is a waste of resources or time, etc. I think that's a good practice. Continual training, to your point, Dr. Pitkin, I think is very important, because oftentimes some farms you won't have any turnover at all. In other farms you have new staff members fairly regularly joining the team. And I think in those situations it's really important to make sure those folks are trained. One of the things that I think is important for someone in an auditing function is not just that they're the police officer going to the farm making sure that things are happening correctly, but that person also carries some burden for the training and being the champion of biosecurity. And so one of the things that auditors do with many of the farms that I work with is that they'll not only go to the farm, perform an audit on a monthly basis, but yet they'll also sit down with the crew at break time and they'll lead a discussion with the team, often about timely topics on biosecurity, and oftentimes they give a quiz. So they'll hand out a piece of paper to everybody and there's, you know, 5 questions or 8 questions on it that they have to answer. And then it becomes kind of fun, actually. You can imagine sort of the dynamic in a break room table on a sow farm, going over a quiz that has a few trick questions on it and arguing. But all of that is a teachable moment, right? And beyond teaching, it also creates an atmosphere that biosecurity is sort of raised to the pinnacle. It's the topic we're talking about today. It's the most important thing we're going to discuss today. And I think that's important at keeping biosecurity on the forefront.
At your farms, you had biosecurity champions as a day-to-day employee, and how do you think that's improved or helped biosecurity? Have you felt like they've caught more things, or they've been able to identify risks, or how has that improved biosecurity in the system?
Those farms where we've named sort of a biosecurity champion, or we call them an FCT, a filter compliance technician, because they were on farms that installed air filters. And so once filters were installed in some of these sow farms, we understood that there was a greater labor requirement, a greater manpower requirement, in order to make sure that all of the biosecurity that had to go into place to make a farm fully filtered under a negative pressure situation required more focus. And so One individual was dedicated as the FCT, and they were responsible for going around the farm every day and making sure that there was no backdrafted air getting into the farm. It was the aerosol biosecurity that was sort of the driver of that position. But then also, they were expected to focus on all of the routes of mechanical transmission. And so they looked at all the critical access points on the farm, and they made sure all the doors were locked, and they made sure that we were following the right biosecurity in the entryway, that the floor was clean and the bench was in the right place and all of those kinds of things. And so I do think that having a champion on the farm, if you will, is important. In the end, everybody needs to focus on biosecurity, right, as we've already said. And yeah, one of the other cliches is biosecurity is a team sport. It's not an individual sport. It's a team sport because everybody's got to be on the same team and headed in the same direction together.
Yeah, I guess call it another cliche or hashtag or theme, but one of the things that I've been trying to promote or push when it comes to biosecurity is when you work in production, you hear all the time, what are the three things pigs need? Feed, water, and you typically hear air or a good environment. They need those things to be comfortable and successful and grow and become good pigs. Well, I'm arguing that pigs need four things. They need feed, water, air, and biosecurity. And I think it would be really neat to see biosecurity added to the end of that phrase, that I think that will help start to create a culture, because everybody knows, again, you got to give them good feed, you got to give them good water. Why don't we know that you have to give them good biosecurity too? It's like, it's kind of thought about, but it needs to be more like, yes, this is what we need to do.
I think you make a great point. And that's, you've said it in a great way. It's almost a welfare component.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, sick pigs is not it's not good for animal welfare, right? And so biosecurity is the thing we can all do to improve pig welfare, to protect pig welfare. I think it's important to at least, sort of draw that together for staff, and I think once you do, they get it, and they're like, oh yeah, that's important. Because most of the people that work on farms today, they care about the pigs, they care about the animals, they're there to, because they like the farm, they like the animals, and they want to do whatever they can to protect them. And if you draw that link to the welfare of the animal, I think that's important.
Do you have a biosecurity wish list? Boy, I wish that we had a new spray that melted. You know, what is there anything out there that, you know, when you've been thinking about, boy, you know, I'll be thrilled when somebody comes out with fill in the blank.
I've always wished I had a magic wand. I just wave it over the farm and it would never get sick. That's what I've always wanted.
But if you're going to wish, then why not wish big?
I mean, absolutely. I agree.
A bubble, yeah.
Yeah, a bubble. That would be good. Yep.
Like the Metrodome, the old Metrodome, right? When you walked out of that building and you were, like, thrown out. We need bubbles like that over our farms.
I wish it was easier to see. I think that's one of the main hurdles with biosecurity.
So I'm imagining an ultraviolet flashlight, where you check your hotel room bed before you get into it at night to make sure that it works. Is that what you, I mean, something like that, easier to see.
Yeah, I mean, to help visualize the risks, and that's a big hurdle with biosecurity is, I mean, you can see a sick pig when you're walking pens. You can't see a biosecurity risk typically. I mean, we conceptualize it in our heads and work hard to paint those pictures for people, but you just don't see those risks laying on the sidewalk.
Yeah, Dr. Waddell makes a great point. And one of the things I've always wished for is to better understand, after a farm does become sick, what was the breakdown? What was the breach in biosecurity that occurred? We think that we know we've got all the biosecurity and we've got everything handled, right? But farms still get sick. And so oftentimes we go and do an investigation. And sometimes these can be pretty intense investigations. We've all done those, right? But in the end, it's rare that we can say, I know exactly how the disease got in. We always find multiple biosecurity breaches. But to be able to say and prove in a court of law that I've got undeniable evidence that that's how the bug got in, except for contaminated breeding stock or semen, there's generally, it's really difficult to prove. And that's what I wish, because I think that would give us a leap forward, right, in better protecting and better understanding, is that we don't have that 20/20 hindsight, really, after a farm breaks to say, yep, it was that. We all kind of have our own little, yeah, I kind of think it was that, but those are our own pet biases oftentimes and that sort of thing. I really question a lot of times when people say they just know. I'm like, I don't know if you do. Anyway, that might not be a popular statement to some people, but I've done enough of those and been humbled enough on PRRS infections in sow farms to know that, we generally don't know. If we did, then we'd fix it and we wouldn't get another break again.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you had that crystal ball, how amazing would that teachable moment be and impactful to truly show, you know, this is where we went wrong, and now we know what we need to do to fix it. Because I completely agree. And a lot of the PRRS investigations that I've done, you probably get lucky if you can narrow it down to four or five things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm stealing somebody's quote. It's usually you walk in and you're looking for the smoking gun. Well, we find 10 of them.
Yeah, there's guns laying all over the place.
Exactly.
You know, the closest thing that we had was during PED, when in some of those breaks, we were able to go to the feed bin and find the actual virus in the feed that the pigs were eating when they became sick. And even then, it's like you could have people that could contest it, right? But work was done further to show that it would transmit in the feed, et cetera. But that was about the closest, you know, other than getting semen from an infected boar stud, right? I mean, it's pretty hard.
Dr. Picken, on the away from the crystal ball piece or the wish list, what is realistic on the horizon for biosecurity innovations?
Great question. I think if it was going to make a realistic list, it would be monitoring techniques that didn't break the bank. And I'm thinking of things like Dr. Nurum and the Pipestone system implemented a protocol where you were swabbing everybody that came into the barn. And I think that's great conceptually, but as you could probably attest, how many samples, how much money do you have to go through until you find that positive? And then does that positive turn into a transmission event?
It's really cheap until you have to test the samples.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause Q-tips aren't that expensive.
No.
But when you start running first PCRs, that adds up pretty fast. Yeah.
So, you know, I've been, you know, trying to conceptualize, you know, how can we come up with a monitoring system or some type of an alert system? When the air sampler machines came out, I always envisioned, could you mount those on a pole connected to a PCR machine, and you could be taking like real-time air samples and understanding, is it a high-risk day or is it a low-risk day? Well, that's not really going to do you any good unless you're filtered. And, you know, so it's things like that, you know, should we be swabbing trailers when they back up to the farm? You know, it would help us to know which gun is smoking the most if we had samples at certain points to help understand.
What do you guys think is the single most important biosecurity, we'll call it intervention, or factor? Like if you could do one thing to a farm, and only one, what would it be?
Culture. I mean, it's, we we can't reliably bank on one thing. It's the whole ball of wax, and getting everyone to pull on the same rope would be the one thing that everybody's looking at, those critical control points. I don't think you can narrow it down to the people, supplies, mortality, and pig movements as big buckets. Mm-hmm.
The clean, dirty line. You know, I try to talk to the farms about, you know, what's your favorite sports team? So I'm a Minnesota Gopher, right? And we're maroon and gold. And that one's easy for me. The farm is gold. It's pristine. It's clean. And everything out there else that touches the perimeter of that gold is the maroon. That's the dirty. And we don't want to turn our gold a murky brown. We want to keep very clear gold, and we want to keep very clear maroon. So I think stressing that clean, dirty line is one of the most important things that we can do, and it becomes a little bit more complicated than that, but that's the base of it. And totally agree with Dr. Waddell. The culture drives respecting that clean, dirty line.
Joining us on The Squeal today were Pipestone's Dr. Joel Neerham, along with PIC's Dr. Jess Waddell and Andrea Pitkin, discussing biosecurity concerns and concepts. You're welcome to share this PIC podcast widely in your organization. In fact, we encourage it. For PIC, the international leader of continuous genetic improvement in swine breeding stock and in world-class technical support to the global pork supply chain, I'm Ned Arthur. Thanks for joining us.